This is not like TV, only better.
Television! Teacher! Mother!
Secret lover.
What, that's it? That's your movie?
Well, I said that I had an idea for a movie.
Folks, this is Screen Watching. It's our weekly deep dive into what we've watched on screens. My name's Dan Barrett, joined by Simon Foster. Simon, I'll just assume that you're well. We'll put that into the minutes, and let me tell you how I am. Okay. I've spent my entire afternoon reading up on Fido Dido in Wikipedia, and boy, has it been a deep dive.
What is Fido Dido? Is this something I should know about? Is this what the cool kids are talking about? Hello, everyone.
Yeah, look, I mean, maybe back in 1989, 1990, when Fido Dido was a very popular mascot for 7-Up globally.
Oh, of course, I remember Fido Dido. I thought it was the singer with bad teeth, but that's Jewel, who I always confuse with Dido. But Fido Dido was the dog emblem of a very popular soft drink at the time.
Wasn't a dog. He's a very hip teenage boy, or young man, at least. I don't know if he's still a teenager.
Nice.
You know, certainly has.
What sent you down this path?
Yeah, just, you know, general interest.
Really? General interest? Really?
Yeah.
We've got a very busy podcast to talk about. We've got all sorts of things going on. It's the week of Mission Impossible, my friend. I almost pitched to you a full sort of Tom Cruise standalone episode, very similar to the ones that doesn't, the one we did last week on Harrison Ford's Indiana Jones that dozens of people listened to.
Sorry, Simon, didn't we only do that one because you had to pre-record an episode because you didn't want to record 1 week, so that was a filler episode? Yeah,
because I was in the wilds of Tasmania for most of last week, which is beautiful, the prehistoric Tarkine temperate rainforest of Tasmania. But I digress. I'm an old man talking about traveling. That's always interesting.
Well, it was awkward. I decided, speaking of old man activities, I logged onto Facebook and I got onto Facebook and I was confronted very first post of a picture of Simon Foster in his underoos. And I just closed the browser and said, that's it, Facebook, I'm out.
I'm bringing Facebook down from the inside with pictures of me in my underwear diving into icy water. We literally stumbled across a beach swim in the middle of June in Tasmania on the eve of my birthday. And I thought, if I'm ever going to do this, and I really ought to, it's going to be right now, which was quite a thrill. Parts of me are still screaming. So it was very, very cold.
Look, hello, sounds like a big mistake.
Yeah,
Simon. Okay, a couple of things. First of all, sorry, we've got some agenda setting to do for the episode here. Number one, I'm looking at the run sheet for this week. I don't see a section to talk about Fido Dido, and suddenly I feel all that research is maybe wasted. Second thing, you went to the Mission Impossible launch in Sydney earlier this week. Now, I don't think we want to dilly-dally too much on this one, but you've seen Tom Cruise in the flesh?
Yes, very close. Yes. If you go to our Facebook page and to our YouTube channel, you can see his full introductory speech with Hayley Atwell and director Christopher McQuarrie and Pom Clementieff, who's terrific in the film.
Well, star of the Guardians of the Galaxy movies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and you can watch us sing "Happy Birthday." But it's a big fun night out. We're going to touch more on it in our intermission segment today. But I had a blast. It was a big whole old school red carpet premiere, as only the biggest movie star in the world can offer up. So yeah, it was a good time.
Yeah, I was kind of, you know, I wouldn't say upset, but, you know, certainly a little bit disappointed that I couldn't be at an event like that. But then I saw the video of everyone seeing Tom Cruise, movie superstar, happy birthday. And I was like, oh, thank God I didn't go. It just vomited in my mouth entirely. But let's move on. We've got some stuff to talk about. We've got reviews. You're going to be talking about the new Mission Impossible movie, Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning, Part 1. Great title. I'm going to talk about a brand new show on Prime Video. It's called The Horror of Dolores Roach. I am pretty certain you know nothing about this. I'm pretty certain every person listening to this knows nothing about it. Stick around. This show is going to rock your world. Nimona, that's a new movie on Netflix. It's animated, as I believe, and you're going to be reviewing that one, Simon. And that's good because I haven't seen that movie or know anything about it. So it would be awkward if I was looking after that one. And finally, I'm going to do the review of Gold Diggers, a brand new Australian comedy on the ABC. Don't go away. Like, listen to what I have to say. Like, it's going to be fine. Just relax. I know what I just said then was confronting. And then after that, we're going to swing back to talking about your little Mission Impossible Sydney little soiree thing, because we're going to start talking about the idea of these large mega launch events and whether or not they actually have any value in 2023 going forward. But folks, stick around. Big podcast. Not as much Fido Dido as I think we all would have liked, but stick around. We'll see what happens. Okay, movie event of the year that wasn't the Super Mario Brothers movie, that wasn't Indiana Jones, that wasn't The Flash, that wasn't Guardians of the Galaxy. It's Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning, Part 1.
Our lives are the sum of our choices. And we cannot escape the past. Ethan? This mission of yours is gonna cost you dearly.
I think we're both very excited about the arrival of the latest Mission Impossible film, which is very boldly putting out the front that A, it's 163 minutes long, and B, it's only part one of the story. The first thing you're going to learn is that don't be put off by that. This is the story itself is very self-contained, and although it sets up a cliffhanger ending of sorts for the part two of Dead Reckoning, it is also a very exciting tale within itself. I am not going to get too bogged down into the minutiae of the plotting. Suffice to say that whereas many of the other villains in the Mission Impossible franchise have been flesh and blood people, the villain in this one is an AI villain called the Entity, which is slowly taking over all aspects of the internet sort of in a very AI kind of way. Oh, what are you putting your hand up for, Dan Barrett?
Sorry, is this literally a movie where you sit down watching Tom Cruise as Ethan Hunt sitting down typing commands into a chatbot? Is that what this is about?
Look, it isn't not about that. They don't. There's really only about 80 or 90 minutes of the whole 160 where he's typing into a computer. So you've really got nothing too much to worry about. No, It's not like that at all. Without going on and on, because this is a very sort of complicated plot that is very swiftly and succinctly told by director Christopher Worry. It's Dan.
Sorry, I was trying to get an internet connection set up during the week, and I was on Telstra.com and talking to one of their artificial chatbots, and it was guiding me through the process, and I didn't get very far. And my question is this villain, what was called the Entity, is that correct? Mm-hmm. Is that a greater villain than the Telstra.com chatbot? Because I struggle to believe it could be true.
Yeah, I mean, the Telstra.com chatbot is very much a real world villain. This is only a movie villain, so it could never compare to what Telstra has to offer.
Yeah, fair. Sorry, really, you interrupted.
It's a mission impossible to get through to Telstra at the best of times. But look, this one is very much set up for the big stunts that have always been part of the Mission Impossible franchise. You only have to tell, and it seems like a very simple thing to say, but you only have to tell the most basic of story elements and weave your way through a very well-structured but quite a simplistic plot so as to hang your big stunts on. And this has some huge stunts, and not only huge stunts as in the well-publicized driving a bike off a cliff thing that he did, which has been all over the internet now for the last 6 weeks. This actually has some amazing set pieces, the likes of which Mission Impossible seems to be the only franchise that pulls off in this kind of way. They did an amazing one in Vatican City back, I think, in number 3, and, of course, the big hanging from the building in Dubai a couple of episodes ago. In this one, there's a few sequences, notably a train sequence, a sequence in an airport, which is just bravado cutting and editing and big screen movie making. And it opens with this great sequence in a Russian submarine, which sets in motion the impact that the Entity can have on the real world and the world of espionage and military shenanigans. Cruise, of course, is in his element. He's aging with this role in much the same way that Indiana Jones had to confront his older elements, his older aspects of life in last week's film. Ethan Hunt's Cruise is kind of in the same position he was all those years ago in the Brian De Palma original, but also a man who's put aside the sort of work duties that ruled his life and does realize the power of his friends, played by Ving Rhames and Simon Pegg and Rebecca Ferguson and the like. Vanessa Kirby is back as the White Widow, I think she's called. So you have a big, loud, big screen movie, and this is very much a film that has been designed to be seen on the very biggest screen possible. And I know there's an old school element that maybe wants to detract from that, and I'm looking at you, Dan Barrett, but
Sorry, what did you say? I wasn't listening to you. What am I distracting from?
The influence and impact of seeing a film on the biggest screen possible, especially a film like this, which is actually shot in a way that enhances the biggest screen presentation and certainly helps in audience enjoyment of it. So I think it nails it. I think it's a terrific piece of entertainment. I didn't feel the 163 minutes. I thought it earned every minute of it. So, one of the better blockbusters of the year.
Yeah, I mean, I hope it flies by as quickly as Avatar did, but, you know, we'll see how that goes. Simon, I think my big question is, why is this being released here on a Saturday in Australia? That is bizarre.
In all my years of movie going, I can't recall that being the case. There must be some sort of behind-the-scenes corporate reason they're doing it. But, yeah, it's out here in Australia July 8th.
My assumption is that they didn't want the Australian release happening before the US release, would be my guess.
But it is happening before the US release. It's not out till the 12th in the US.
Oh, really? Okay, then baffling. I don't understand what's going on then.
And to plop it on a Saturday, I guess that's a kind of a big deal. But, yep, who knows? I mean, it's the sort of film that's just going to pull in audiences regardless. It'll be interesting to see what sort of numbers it does, because it's his first one after Top Gun. It's a very successful franchise that's sort of known for doubling down on the one that went before it. I don't think it's quite the best of the series. It's certainly the lightest in tone of the series. There's some fun elements in there that neither Cruise and he's terrific with Hayley Atwell. That's where all the fun stuff comes from. And the big car chase scene in Rome is certainly done in a lightness of touch that you'd never see from past directors like De Palma or John Woo. But I think it works a treat.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think it's going to do bigger box office than the previous one. I think it's going to hover similar. And like post Top Gun, I don't think that's an issue. No one cares that it's a Tom Cruise movie. They care that it's Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible. Like, no one's excited about that Tom Cruise factor per se.
I don't know if I agree with that. I still think he's, I don't think it's arguably. I think he is the one big movie star name in the world at the moment that can still open a film because it's a Tom Cruise film. He hasn't been given that opportunity for a few years now. He went through that period where he's doing things like Valkyrie and Night of Day, which got to a certain level of box office but didn't do huge things. It's all been franchise stuff lately. Lion for Lambs was very much a
movie that nobody saw.
An award piece as well. Yeah, for sure. But
did it win any awards? I don't think it did.
All right, okay. You're zeroing in on Lions for Lambs for some reason. Okay, fine. Let's look forward to it. That was also 13 years ago. So let's have a look at what have we got up next?
Well, I mean, sorry, if we want to go to a recent example, here's Mummy Remake. That was only, two films ago?
It was about 6 or 7 years ago and got critically panned, but actually did box office business. So it was the critical drubbing that it got that put the sort of death nails into the Universal Monsters franchise that it was going to open up. So, and I didn't mind it. I actually thought it was okay. I had no sort of qualms with it.
Oh, why don't you just go marry him? Jeez. Okay, Simon, let's move on. I'm going to talk about a brand new show that's debuting this week. Debuting this week. It's Friday. It's in a couple of hours' time as we record this. It's a TV series called The Horror of Dolores Roach.
16 years they locked my ass up for possession with intent.
Dolores Roach in the flesh. It's been like forever, mommy.
You look like shit.
Well, I have no money. We're not hiring today.
No job prospects. And I bet that your boss's dad died, so I'm pretty sure I know I look like shit. Thank you very much.
Okay, Simon, I'm going to guess you know nothing about this program.
Only in that I saw you put in the running sheet and I thought to myself, he's going to bring up that I know nothing about this program, so I better have a look at the trailer. And yeah, the trailer looks terrific. I'm sort of on board for what it's offering. But no, I don't know anything significant about the what is it called? The Horrors of Dolores Roach.
The Horror of Dolores Roach. And I'll be honest, until, what did I watch it, like Tuesday evening? I knew nothing about it. I literally watched it because I was like, this feels like a dead week. I'm just going to have to try to watch something. And I knew that was debuting on Prime Video. I went, let's go for that. Simon, this is one of my shows of the year. Wow. It's fantastic. Prime Video has been on a real run of it this last year. I think it's, if you want to find a good comp, this sits very nicely alongside a show that they had on Prime Video a couple of months ago called Swarm, which, if you remember that one, that was about a young African-American girl who obsessed with a pop star, fairly financially impoverished. And so she ends up sort of leading into a life of becoming a serial killer, which sort of mixed in with a fandom of this pop star. It was a very bleak, dark, very funny, strange half hour of TV. But it was like a one and done season. And Dolores Roach, I've only seen the first two, but I would presume this is probably a one and done show, especially based on the way that this opens. It's funny, it's dark, it's twisted. Much like Swarm, quite a fair bit of murdering taking place in this one. So the premise of it is there's a young woman in her early 20s. She is in a relationship with a guy who's a neighborhood drug dealer in Crown Heights. The two of them are living a pretty happy existence together. She is promised a fair bit of wealth coming her way based on the rolls of money that are hiding in the wall of their apartment. Cuts a couple of days after she's made a promise that this will buy you your house. Knock on the door, some DEA agents come in, arrest her. She's a very honest very noble person. Doesn't rat out her boyfriend at all. He provides her no support whatsoever. They throw her the maximum sentence they can. And so 16 years later, she comes out of prison and she'd kind of like to get what's owed to her, only she can't find her ex-boyfriend. Nobody seems to know where he is. And the entire world just moved on, even to the point where she rocks up at Crown Heights to go to her old apartment, then suddenly sees that the greatest horror of all has taken place. It's been gentrified.
Yeah.
And so that's largely what this is about. So she's rocking up in this highly gentrified neighborhood. The one person who remembers her takes her in and is the guy that runs a local empanada store. Anyway, that store is going under, but she's allowed to live like in his basement. That helps her out because she's got all of $200 to her name and she ends up taking on a career as a masseuse. I'm not going to go too much further than that, only because that's as far as I've seen. But I will say this is a show that very nicely mixes a lot of social commentary in terms of gentrifications of neighborhoods, the actual ability for everyday people to be able to afford to keep on living in regions that they lived in. When you start thinking about the rent discrepancies that they start discussing in episode 2, which has a very funny guest appearance by Marc Maron. Don't expect him in episodes beyond episode 2 is all I'm saying. But you get that from when he walks in the door. That's not a big surprise. And also considering what the show is about, they're very open saying that she will be doing a lot of murdering in this basement. And yes, she gets started.
This sounds really interesting.
Yeah, they talk about the fact that when she moved into the neighborhood like 16 years ago before she went to the big house, she was paying like $500 or something a month in rent. And now it's something like $7,000. So this is kind of the impact of what happens to neighborhoods like that and people like her who kind of fall through the cracks of the system and society.
Might I suggest that both at the more commercial end of things and the more mainstream end of television with Abbott Elementary and with some of the more darker streamer type, no pun intended, darker streamer type titles like the Boots Riley one from a couple of weeks ago you reviewed, and this and Swarm.
That would be another great Prime Video series called I'm a Virgo.
I'm a Virgo. Am I getting a sense that there's a real sort of, if not a renaissance, then some African-American artists and writers and creatives are bringing some of the best stuff that's on American television at the moment?
Oh, look, certainly at the moment. I think it's because they've largely got something to say. We're in a cultural moment at the moment where, a lot of people get hung up on identity politics. But ultimately, these are shows that aren't really interested in identity politics so much as interested in the way that there's been systematic failures which have left people sort of falling through the cracks. So there's a lot of, deeper intellectual thought going into what are sort of very largely genre-based storytelling. I mean, it's not that different to think about like that sort of mid to late 70s period where blaxploitation films really started kicking off. And you'd have to think that a lot of that's inspiration for what they're coming up with here, which is genre heavy, but also speaking very much from, cultural experience in a way that I think that we haven't seen realized properly on the screen for some time.
Are these creative people getting a shot because Donald Glover's Atlanta was such a zeitgeisty kind of success and moment?
I mean, keep in mind, Swarm was a Donald Glover produced TV series.
Exactly.
I don't think it's just Atlanta. I think that Atlanta was just one of the first ones that came along that were, really knocking it out of the park in a sort of deeply artistic environment. What I think is probably worth noting is that we're sort of in this period where people are looking at Prime Video as spending a ridiculous amount of money on things like Lord of the Rings TV shows and what was it called? Citadel, which I never watched. I can't bring myself to do it. Apparently it's awful. Look, they're spending all this money here, but they're also spending money on these much smaller projects, things like Swarm. And I suspect because of the Donald Glover side of things, that was probably more expensive than it looked on screen. But you look on screen and that looks like it's a dingy, dark, low rent production. And purposefully so, like artistically, that makes sense for that. Then you look at I'm a Virgo with lots of very sort of deliberate practical effects in there. And I can't imagine that was a big budget TV show, but I could be surprised, but I don't think they spent a lot of money on that. And this is something where, again, it feels very much like it's a limited number of sets and some cast who aren't broadly really that well known. Like when Marc Maron's one of the biggest names you've got on your show, then ultimately you can sort of look at the level of cast that they're sort of playing around with here. This kind of just feels like another sort of low budget thing. So it's kind of cool to see that Prime Video is taking some very big risks in giving some filmmakers the opportunity to create these sorts of programs.
That's interesting. And I'm going to go off topic a little bit here, off running sheet.
Just briefly, just to add on to that, there's obviously, and I acknowledge this, a great irony that Amazon, the world's biggest retailer and probably the company that's responsible for removing a large number of small businesses and helping gentrify areas like Crown Heights with, you know, you don't necessarily need mom and pop stores in a place like that anymore because you can just get it all delivered. Like there's a great irony in the fact that it's also them who are producing these TV series that have so much to say about the plight of the working class African-American.
As someone who's old like me and who puts so much weight in that last great golden decade of Hollywood in the 70s, I am finding upon reflection that the streamers are starting to take shape and starting to really emit a kind of individual personality in what they do. I can see in what Amazon's doing where they're taking big expensive swings with Citadel and Lord of the Rings and maybe having a few flops, but they're also doing the smaller, more indie-minded stuff. There's an element of what Sony did coming out of the 70s with that. Apple has less releases but are really playing the prestige card in what they put out there most of the time and attracting some very big names to what they do. Then you've got Netflix, which has kind of got that cookie-cutter reputation. Would you agree with that or do you have a different take on it?
I don't know. I think that's maybe being a bit.
Are they all still the same? I
think it's being a bit generous. Like, I think that's being generous. I think that we're certainly seeing a bit of a wave of these series coming through from Prime Video, but I wouldn't say that it's necessarily part of the identity that's baked into what Prime Video is about at the moment. I think it's probably just there's a conversation taking place within Prime Video, and so as these projects are making their way through, some things are seeing their way through. It's the same as any organization, you know, culturally there's like a specific sort of vibe that's going on and you start working towards like that cultural sort of understanding, but like, I don't think it speaks necessarily to a broader strategy or anything like that. I think it's just
interesting.
Yeah.
All right. So what's this called and where do we watch it?
So this one's called The Horror of Dolores Roach. And I will say from the very beginning, it's built very much around like a Sweeney Todd kind of a vibe to it, and I was deeply concerned because I knew nothing about it that within 30 seconds it was suddenly going to become a musical. Not a musical, it's absolutely something which I could stomach, so you know, take that for what it is.
Can I tell you a quick funny story about Sweeney Todd? I'm gonna do it anyway. God bless her dear heart, my late mother-in-law Kath Williams, we decided to take to the movies one night. And because of the very nature of Sweeney Todd and the great butcher of Fleet Street and the horrors that he brought upon the English people, we knew she'd love it because she loved the true crime stuff.
And hates the British.
What we didn't know and what she was quite shocked by is that it's entirely sung. It's an opera and she hates musicals. So she was sitting there fighting with her, I love true crime, blood and gore, but oh my God, I hate musicals. And she sat there stony faced through the entire Sweeney Todd. And at the end of it, we both looked at her and she goes, what the bloody hell was that all about? So yes, I'm sure she'd love Dolores Roach if she was around. God bless you, Kat.
Yeah, maybe.
She would. All right, let's have a look at the next thing. I'm going to review a little film called Nimona.
The name's Nimona. Your sidekick has arrived.
I don't need a sidekick.
Every villain needs a sidekick.
I'm not a villain. The real villain is still out there, and I do need help.
And then, who do you want to kill first?
What?
Look, I can help you, but promise me you won't freak out.
Why would I trust you?
Promise!
I promise!
Even when you see the horn?
Horn!
Promise!
I promise, promise, I will not freak!
Oh. Nimona, don't mind if I do. I don't know.
That's the
greatest
thing I've ever heard.
Mm.
Okay,
Nimona, I barely knew it. Go on.
On Netflix, just released this week, is a new animated film called Nimona. Animation is very much the hip cool thing at the moment, thanks to Spider-Man. What's it called? Across, isn't it? Or beneath? Or within?
The tourist shop next to the Spider-Verse.
Okay. In Nimona tells the story of a disgraced knight who is unjustly blamed for the murder of a queen, who joined forces with an outcast teenage girl. That's the Nimona of the title. He has to clear his name. She just wants to cause a whole lot of damage and chaos. There's a whole lot of tank girl in Nimona. She's well equipped to do that. She's a shapeshifter, a monster from the deep, dark historical past that is having trouble coming to terms with their own internal monstrous urges, but loves being an eagle or a whale or a mouse or whatever she needs to be to get the job done. She is a very irreverent anti-hero with an absolute talent for destruction. She's also the very monster that the knight, Ballister Boldheart, who's voiced by Riz Ahmed, has been trained to kill. So their friendship is very, very unlikely. This is all set in an incredible sort of Arthurian medieval kind of world, but it's futuristic. The walled city in which they live is all neon and chrome, but the fighting they all do is with swords. The horses they ride are, in fact, electronic type mobiles that skip zoot in and out of the city, like the big buildings and cityscapes of Star Wars. And you've at the center of this, you've got this incredibly voiced performance by Chloe Grace Moretz, with Nimona as this just this bundle of energy and aggro and whip cracking sort of wit, all in the name of a very potent sort of self-realization and self-empowerment storyline, as you expect from a lot of fairy tales and fantasy films, but this one's done in a very contemporary and very enjoyable way. So I am just so in love with Nimona. I watched this because I was so energized by the animation in Spider-Man, and this one I'd read a lot of great things about coming out of the Annecy International Animation Festival that finished up a couple of weeks ago. This was sort of the bell of the ball over there. For it to drop on Netflix, turn it up loud. Don't worry about letting the kids watch it. This one is a very progressive thinking, sort of medieval futuristic adventure. Your two male lead characters are gay and are openly gay in several scenes in this film. And that is just taken as a matter of fact. And it's really refreshing to see, that portrayal of, you know, just the ongoing normalization of something that's just always so often been on the fringe of mainstream entertainment. It's just really terrific to see. So, this is one of, as high as you were on Dolores Rachel, I'm as high on Nimona. It's a great piece of entertainment.
Okay. Oh, possibly give that a go. I don't know.
Yeah, for sure.
Animated stuff.
One's probably too young for this.
Well, this is kind of it. So, like, there's a lot of animation being watched in my house at the moment, and I'd kind of like her to be watching maybe that and maybe a little less Eureka, which I've certainly seen enough of every episode of that many times now.
That was the one that was cancelled, wasn't it? Isn't that off the air?
Supposedly, but I don't think it's been an official confirmation of that. Yeah, I don't know. Okay. Eureka is actually pretty good, but whatever.
Turn her into a little tank girl, like, and get her to watch Nimona. She'll be tearing up the house in no time.
Look, I don't think there's going to be much of a push needed for her to be a little tank girl at this point.
All right, now, you watched an ABC film. Ooh, I'm all ears.
What's a TV series?
Mm-hmm.
Not a film.
Doesn't make it right. Let's see. What's it called?
Okay, this one. It's called Gold Diggers.
Oi, lads! Any of you boys got a nice little shack here in town?
Hard pass. need to hard launch ourselves on this town.
Operation Sugar Daddy.
So what's the plan?
We're gonna find rich dumb husbands.
And or lovers, preferably old, so they die soon.
Simon, let me paint you a picture here. It's 1853. Two ratbag sisters from Sydney travel to the Australian Gold Rush in search of their own treasure, some newly rich idiots. Now, that's the blur, but that's not strictly what it's about. They don't need to be newly rich. They're willing to take people that have had money in a family for generations. Like, they're fine. But really, it is about these two women who are bawdy, very out there, progressive young women who are tired of being poor. They're running from something in Sydney. I've watched the first 3 episodes, and I don't think they've revealed at this stage as to what's going on. I'm pretty sure it's 3 episodes I've seen. There's only 3 episodes available for people to watch right now on iView, and I strongly recommend you do. I sat down watching this, and the joke of this, the gimmick of it, is that you got these two women played by Claire Lovering and Danielle Walker, the two of them who are both hilarious. As I said, they're progressive and they're very modern women. But a lot of the jokes in this is that everyone's speaking with a very modern cadence. Like, you know, they go to a Buschdorf, like there's that kind of thing taking place in this. I saw that and like they started talking. I'm like, yeah, I get the joke, but like the actual jokes weren't very funny. But the thing is that it takes me about 5 or 10 minutes for them to like settle into the rhythm of it. And then once they've gotten past what they think is the joke, which is that these people speak very progressively and very modern, once you get past that and they actually start doing some proper jokes, it is really good. It's super entertaining. These two are incredibly charismatic leads. The entire supporting cast, which includes people like Eddie Perfect, like everyone just absolutely sings off the screen. They're not singing. Again, this isn't a musical. This is, but you know, just the comedy hits the comedic notes hereafter. It's a tight little fun half hour. I was going to say, like, the whole thing with them speaking very sort of modernly seems to be a trend that we're seeing at the moment. So obviously we've seen the TV show The Great recently, which was very much a similar take as the writer whose name I was trying to bring to mind just then. Can't think of it.
The Australian guy.
Yeah.
The Oscar for that Olivia Colman thing that I
can't. Which was also, as I understand it, very much sort of people speaking in very sort of modern cadence as well.
And there's the thing from the Broken Lizards guys with the Hunchback on Hulu. Oh, that's also
Broken Lizard stuff. They made one good movie. Let's talk them up again. Let's not give them anything else to do, please.
But it's the same sort of thing. It's taking a medieval setting and giving it contemporary voices. Yeah, that's it.
Okay, I guess. And all the jokes are really dirty. They're funny. There's a great... I don't want to give away the premise of... there's one episode where they appear in the local beauty pageant. And... magnifique. like, this is the thing, like, the show is basically, it's a joke machine engine. There's nothing you can really sort of say about it. You just kind of need to experience it, but just know strong performances. It is actually laugh out loud funny. The person to really watch out for is, and I'm trying to find the actor, I think it's Katanya Maynard. Is that her? Sorry, she's got like a lot of costuming taking place. So I'm trying to work out who the actor is playing her. And I can't think of the character's name. Could that be her? I'm not sure. Sometimes IMDb
is, she like
it's
the
just
Kramer
hard to tell.
Of the episode? Is she like the
basically? Basically, these two women have this friend of theirs who's just every bit the I'm going to say every bit the slapper that these two are. Okay. However, she ended up, and you do see a good sort of flashback as Barry, the bartender, played by Eddie Perfect, explains. He gives the backstory of this character, and right. She turned up in town basically as herself, but engaged in a bit of a marketing campaign talking about this very fancy French lady that's going to be coming to town. Okay. And so you see like a number of like her whisper campaign take place around town. And then suddenly she comes with this really terrible, heavy French accent and inability to really speak the language properly. But she comes in and then gets the wealthiest man in town to fall for her. But the wealthiest man in town is probably a bit more interested in the houseboy that lives in the house rather than her. Okay. So they've got a very, highly eroticized but very at a distance sexual relationship between the two of them.
Might I suggest that
please
with
do.
This show with, I know you're not a fan, but I'm enjoying Utopia at the moment, with the other one, the Boone, what's the one, the Lock Boone or something? What's the one set in?
Deadlock. Yeah, I did not care for it, but go on. Yep.
Okay, but might I suggest that there's a bit of a new wave, a bit of a fresh voice in Australian television that is at least noteworthy at this point in time. There seems to be a lot of
Let's all look to the show that's been on the air for, what, 6 years? Well, six seasons with like a three-year gap called Utopia. I don't think we can call that a fresh wave. I think it's just that.
Well, it's, I mean, it hit the ground running. It hasn't sort of stumbled out of the blocks. It is as effortlessly funny as it was the first time around. Plus, you've got these two that other two. All I'm suggesting is that there's a rare selection of relatively new Australian shows on telly at the moment that offer up a good laugh, a good time.
I mean, look, I didn't have a good time with Deadlock, and I don't have a good time with Utopia, but I appreciate I'm in a minority on Utopia, and the three people that watch Deadlock seem to like it.
Maybe, I don't know whether just because I was down in Tasmania, but I had a lot of people talking about Deadlock and saying,
I think that's a selective audience there, Simon.
Little niche, little focus. Hello to all our Tasmanians listeners. I met you both, and you're very sweet.
Look, I'm sure that Deadlock's doing just fine. I've seen people speaking favorably of it on... on the socials, but yeah. I've never heard anyone in real life talk about it. But then again, I never hear real life people talk about TV anyway, so
I don't talk to people.
Unfair.
So that's an interesting bunch of reviews. Well done, Dan Barrett.
It's called Gold Diggers. It's currently streaming on the ABC. I think it's an 8-episode series, and there's 3 episodes that launched on day 1 on the iView, and so that launched a couple of days ago, so you can start watching that there.
Talent. Intermission time.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's intermission time.
All right, so we hit the middle bit, as it used to be called, or the intermission segment of our show. Now, as I mentioned early on, I had a big week out at Darling Harbour down on Monday night for the premiere of Mission Impossible Dark Reckoning. Is that what it's called? Something like that.
Dead Reckoning, Part 1.
Dead Reckoning, Part 1. And just as that was sort of buzzing my world, an article popped up during the week on Mumbrella, which really questioned whether these big traditional red carpet events, and we should point out that the Mission Impossible one was a bigger than usual event. It was a huge evening and a huge staging of it. Others are more sort of the red carpet event at your local event cinemas. But the article questioned whether these red carpets event are having any ongoing impact anymore, whereas they were traditionally very popular with Hollywood types and launching films and TV shows. It's now all about experiential activations. They're the two buzzwords in the world of PR at the moment. These are like immersive events where you can get your photos taken and it's easy to share this sort of stuff. The influencers love it. And I'm just putting it out there. We're two red carpet veterans. Do any of these have any worthiness? Is there any spin on the traditional red carpet format that might still work in this day and age? And what might be the future of this kind of event that is determined to get publicity but doesn't always do it?
So I would say that red carpet events are rubbish, and I don't think they get any cut through whatsoever and haven't for quite a number of years, if ever.
Give me something to work with here.
I don't think they do. Every time I ever went to an event where there was a red carpet thing, like, sure, there's people who turn up to the red carpet who are probably excited about the film. Let's assume that it's films that we're talking about here. They're excited about the film anyway. Like, they've already bought in. Okay, but outside of like maybe a few photos appear on their Instagram, like there's no cut through. Like it doesn't go beyond the event as it took place. So nobody in attendance is necessarily won over. The social component of it, I don't think is particularly that strong. And like it's not like these things really get any sort of TV coverage generally. Like that doesn't really happen. And even if it does get TV coverage, Simon, or even radio coverage, like viewership on TV is well and truly... if we're talking about movies here and you're looking for TV coverage, your average age for the TV viewers, 50 plus, and a lot of those viewers aren't turning up for the big event movies at the cinema. So,
okay. So you cover a lot of ground there and that's fair enough.
Well, I'm just saying I don't think they work, but I think there are things they could be doing. And so I'm just going to do my little rant and then we can come over and fill in the things. So reading this Mumbrella piece, they were talking about these experiential activations. But the sense I got from reading that Mumbrella piece was that they were talking about the ones where, you know, suddenly all these influencers get invited to one of these events and take photos and, you know, take home the goodie bag or whatever and then talk about it on their socials. I don't think that really works either. And I think it's like a particularly Australian thing where I feel that some of the ones that actually do work, we haven't really seen PR locally sort of embark on these yet. So what I'm actually more interested in is things like you're seeing, and Netflix seems to be particularly good at this, launching these events in large cities in the US. So Los Angeles and New York tends to be where you see a lot of these things, where what they'll do is they'll create, for example, Stranger Things. What was it? It was like it was some sort of a drive-in thing where I think they recreated Hawkins and you could kind of drive through. It was like a haunted house kind of a thing. And so it took over like a couple of blocks and you kind of go driving through and people jump out and scare you and do that sort of thing. But it was open to the public. Okay. And I think that's the real difference here. I think that what they need to be doing is creating a lot of events that take place in real spaces that average people get along to and start sharing that on there. Like they should be taking over like pop-up stores in like Westfields and take out costumes from shows. They should be having special events where it might be like a haunted house sort of thing. Maybe it's like a diner you can go to and get the food from, whatever. I was reading an article on Variety today where they were talking, an article on Variety where they were talking about the knives used in The Bear season 2. And it's a really niche article. But an event where if they're promoting The Bear, for example, you turn up and it's a restaurant that's selling the food from The Beef, I think was the name of the restaurant in the first season, something like that. Suddenly you get that social media cut through. It's not just the standard influencers, it's real people. And also because these people have actually had a proper connection to it and aren't invited to these things every second week, they actually have some meaningful connection to it. You've got rusted on fans there that will turn up for every season of the show going on after that because they've got that strong connection to it. Seeing a picture on Instagram, I don't think means that much to most people. Go.
Can I point out that what you're talking about there, whether it's the creepy smilers at the baseball when they released the Smile horror movie a year or so ago, which was very effective, the Stranger Things drive-through, that's marketing. That's all geared towards a specific date on the calendar to get people to watch whatever they're promoting. Now, that date itself has to have some impact and some significance so that when the red carpet is rolled out or Darling Harbour is taken over or EQ down here in Sydney has a X-Wing TIE fighter or something, whatever it is out the front to celebrate the day, then that in itself has got added impetus and added strength and added value as a launch date event.
Yeah, but if nobody hears about it, Simon, then what's the point of it?
I still think there's value to be had in creating a moment in time.
But like,
will resonate with all the hashtaggers and will resonate with specific people on a specific day. And we're doing this in the wake of the Mission Impossible one, which was
I don't understand what you're saying that I haven't just said. Like, ultimately, I'm talking about events which are taking place timed with the release of something, where people can go and have an actual experience, but real people where it's actually going to have some cut through and not just the same, you know, 30 people in a city that get invited to every event.
I don't disagree with that. I agree with all those elements and
should be implemented as... I don't understand why you've got an issue with that. Like you were saying that doesn't have the same cut through in his event that nobody sees and goes to.
Because they've got to be, that's got to be sold. They're trying to sell something. What they're trying to sell is a launch date for that product. To just have those things without an event date attached to it.
But it would be either. Like, I'm not saying set up a Stranger Things event tomorrow when a season isn't coming out in like a year and a half's time. But the Stranger Things I was talking about was like in 2 to 3 weeks leading up to the release of the new season. Like, that's what these things are. And also, I mean,
on that day when Stranger Things launched.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say, and the thing with Netflix as well is that they would argue and suggest that the opening weekend isn't as important to them because they've got a long tail that they're following and wank, wank, wank. That's not really, really true.
But they really are
going for an opening weekend.
Yeah, exactly. As more importantly than ever, our cinemas, our movies, our studios, they're going for that big opening weekend.
Yeah, otherwise, absolutely.
Why is it not even more important than ever to have a major event on the launch date to get the coverage that they're hoping for. I don't entirely agree that there's no cut through.
No, but Simon, what am I saying that isn't getting that same like event thing? Like, okay, let's use my example there, talking about the bear. Okay, so talking about the bear, we're going to say that you're going to set up a restaurant which is selling all the food from the bear. The bear's launching in Australia, what is that, July 17? So in like two weeks' time. So if in like a week's time, so let's say like 5 days before the show's going to launch, suddenly this pop-up diner appears and is selling all the food from the bear, how is that any different to an event which runs for an hour and a half and gets everyone turning up to that? But instead, over a five-day period and maybe a few days past the launch of it, you can go to the restaurant from, you know, selling the bear stuff. Like, I don't understand how that isn't tied to a specific moment in time. Like, explain to me how it isn't. Like, what's the difference you're arguing?
The difference is that there is an element of...
and not being exclusive and you being invited to it?
No.
Yes.
Not true. I can go down to the... I can go down and get my food at the bear.
No, but you can.
Diner. Yeah, exactly. So...
I would suggest for something like that, Simon, they do a night where all your influencers come along to the bear diner, okay, yeah. See an episode of the show, but then that diner stays open for a few days and everyday people get to go along and have an experience. To me, that's a really meaningful thing you can do as an event, but something like the Mission Impossible thing, which I'll be real, I'm a pretty connected person in terms of I'm online a fair bit, I consume a fair bit of media about movies and TV shows. The only time I saw any reference at all to that event that took place was on your social media, on your wife's social media, and like two other people I know that went to the event. Okay, outside of that... Nothing.
Okay, so but you're not looking at the social pages. You're not looking at page 3 of the
Simon. Page 3 doesn't exist anymore, really.
There is still you can't say that with any real backup information.
Well, I can because circulation figures would back me up there, Simon.
Because they're still all out there. People are buying the newspapers. People are watching.
No, they're not, Simon. Look at newspaper circulation figures.
The people who are buying the tickets are. Well, I would argue who are the influencers that are creating some sort of heavily trafficked site that ensures people are going to watch the bear because they set up a diner.
Okay, well, hang on,
that's not going to get any coverage on any of the mainstream media pages.
Let's take a step back. People aren't buying newspapers. Let's take a step back. People aren't buying newspapers, so they're not seeing it at page 3. But where they might see something is a Daily Mail article about it.
You can't just make
that's the modern day version of what you're talking about.
Okay, so you can't just make a blanket statement that that sort of media doesn't have a cut through impact.
No, Simon, it does.
There will be an element that they're aiming at that takes the ground to get the base social class to go and see these movies in the kind of numbers that they need to see them. They're still hitting big mainstream media.
2023 speaking, first of all, newspapers don't exist, but the equivalent of what you're talking about is
I didn't buy that. No, you can't make that judgment. You're saying that nobody watches the 6 o'clock news.
I'm talking about newspapers. Simon.
You're saying the traditional media elements don't exist.
Simon.
I am listening.
Let me finish my sentence. You just want to jump into this thing. So the newspapers don't exist. The Daily Mail is the current version of what you're talking about there. Now, the Daily Mail will just as easily cover said diner like example that I came up with as they will like a Mission Impossible launch thing. Okay, so just keep in mind, so there is like a modern equivalent of that, but it's not the newspapers anymore. Circulation for papers is well and truly dead. There's no reason a newspaper now costs like $4 to buy daily. Like, it's ridiculous. But the newspaper sites, so news.com.au, the Daily Mail, but they would equally cover something which people can actually go to. And then it's encouraging people saying, have a further experience with this thing that you've been reading about. Like, it's not just a look at the attractive people that went to that event. But what my suggestion was is that this diner event, the hypothetical diner event, which I'm hinging this entire argument on, this diner event, you can have your thing where the influencers come out, which gives you your big launch story, but then it's also something which people can actually engage with. And to me, that's what's meaningful. Thinking about the 6 o'clock news, Simon, the interesting thing I was reading during the week was talking about the underperformance of the most recent Indiana Jones movie, which we're going to talk about in a moment, what else you've been watching, because I got to see it. But they were talking about the underperformance of that movie, and you got two stories with this one. One, movies cost way too much money, and so they can never recoup that anymore based on the current marketplace.
Are we staying on topic here?
Simon. I'm swinging back around. Just hold tight. So you've got that, which I think is kind of interesting. But they were actually talking about the people that did turn up to the movie and the fact that the older audience who have the strong connections to Indiana Jones and it's been part of like their media diet for like 40-odd years now, They weren't really turning up to the thing in the numbers that they were. And you'll find the older audience probably will find the movie through possibly home media, but also they may go to like week 3, week 4, week 5. And so you get a bit of a long tail, but not really to the volume that they're kind of after. But for that opening weekend push that you really want, you generally don't get the older viewers coming along to it. And you didn't get the younger viewers turning up for this one. So you maybe did get a bit of an older audience turning up, but you didn't have that big bulk young audience. And taking that a step further, we were talking about Fast X and its underperformance the other week. That's actually suffering a very similar thing where they haven't been stacking the cast of these movies with younger cast members anymore. Instead, the audience has been getting older with these Fast and Furious films, but they're not replacing it with the young people that turn up for the opening weekend. So when you start thinking about traditional media, see, this may bring it full circle back to where we're at. When we're talking about traditional media, like you can say that, yes, the 6 o'clock news still gets a certain amount of audience, but it's not getting those young people that need to arrive for like a day, like an opening weekend of a movie to give it that big sort of cultural push. And also you look at this year where we've got new release movies stacked up weekend after weekend. If you're not getting that opening weekend, like you kind of sunk, like because there's new product coming through so quickly. So you need that opening weekend. Yes, older people will probably discover that Indiana Jones film as it goes on a bit more, but that's not the audience that you want. You need those people, those opening weekend. Traditional media doesn't cut through anymore. You need to go that extra step, which is what they're talking about here, these experiential activations. This is because traditional media doesn't have the cut through for that young audience you need, particularly for movies. Sorry, particularly for Hollywood blockbuster movies.
Yeah, but you're suggesting that slow boil, sort of the diner example that we've used through this is going to get any kind of the same impact or coverage.
I'm saying you're getting different people
that
turning
is required.
You're getting different people turning up who have a greater connection with it. So everyone who went to that Mission Impossible opening are largely people that get invited to every movie screening or every big PR event around the place. Certainly, I know the couple of incidents I saw of people who were actually at the event are all people who go to those sorts of events on the regular. So you're not really getting anyone out of the ordinary going to it. I wasn't seeing any cut through in any of the media that I consume. Okay, and like I'm tapped into like, you know, places where people talk about movies and I just didn't see that coverage come through. So for me, it was a non-event.
We're in a bubble of very sort of specifically, you know, we create our own news cycle and we are not part of the mainstream conversation that happens with weekly releases of movies. So I don't think we can compare the newsletters and the information that we consume is the same as the everyday, you know, mum and dad and 2.5 kids of the suburbs that only hear about this when they sit down to eat dinner in front of the television.
But they're not sitting down in front of the TV. If you're using the experience, the example of the mum, dad, and the two kids, like the mum, dad, and the two kids are my age pretty much, Simon.
Yeah.
My age slightly older. And we're all people that I actually don't think there is a mainstream anymore. And if we want to talk about the experience, those, you know, mum, dad, and the two kids sitting in front of the TV, they're not watching the 6 o'clock news. They're watching something on Netflix. They're watching something on Stan. Like, that's where the viewership is now, Simon. And people aren't. I don't think there's a mainstream. I think people are in their bubbles. And it needs to do a lot to cut through.
I don't agree with that. I don't think the mainstream are on the streamers in the peak viewing times. There's a
Simon, look at the ratings. It shows you the decline of audience.
Well, look at the ratings of your Disney Pluses. They talk about having huge hit shows, and there's still 25. There's still only a quarter of what's being taken to the big networks. Sure, this viewing levels are way down on what we experienced growing up, and the 7, 9s, and 10s don't bring in those, you know, million sort of viewership levels that they used to because of the Netflix. But it's not like when we talk about a huge Netflix release, we're talking about another massive.
You know why that is, Simon? Because Netflix hasn't just got 5 programs. It's got a massive library of movies and TV shows. People have a lot more to choose from. So they're not. So you think about, say, for example, it's 1996.
From a massive library. No, they're so it's 19... about the same 20 or 30 films that are released every week.
Yeah. So, Simon, it's 1996. It's Monday night at 7:30. All of Australia sitting down watching Friends. Okay. That's right. Just what you did. Okay.
Yep.
That was the experience. So you're watching that, and if all of Australia, and it never really was all of Australia, but you know, you're probably getting, you're getting probably like 3-4 million people. Yeah, you're getting 3-4 million people watching it. But okay. The hit show on Netflix, okay, which what's the big thing on Netflix in the last week or two? I don't think there has been a big title on Netflix in the last week or two.
Who's watching Ginny and Georgina or whatever it is?
Ginny and Georgia, great example. Okay, but Ginny and Georgia is interesting because if you looked at the viewership for that, it's probably not doing, because that's one of their biggest titles. I think it was like number 8, 9, or 10 in like their, I think from Nielsen from memory, for like the shows for, as you look at like 2022, that was one of their top 10 shows at the back end of it. Okay, that doesn't mean that it's necessarily probably in Australia going to have that same viewership of Friends, but for Netflix, it is one of the higher performers, but you've got Ginny and Georgia people to be watching that night, along with so many other movies and TV shows. So those things are always going to raise it. And yes, there's also the commentary saying that, what was it? It was like, actually, no, sorry, this was an HBO Max specific thing. So this probably is a fair comparison. But on Max, for example, which is kind of interesting, okay, they were saying that 90% of all of their viewership is of the top 20 programs that are available there. So you don't actually have like the deep library spread, but I think that's a Max specific thing. So we won't use that as an example.
So what's the one point of difference that the traditional TV networks have over this fractured streaming landscape? They are able to present to their viewers coverage of the Mission Impossible premiere, a major movie star event that's happening in Sydney right now. Let's cross to that. Let's show coverage on our 6 o'clock news. Let's have them all on the panel. Let's have all our websites cover that. That's what I'm getting at in terms of why these major events are still important.
Can I say what the advantage is for TV news? The advantage for TV news is they can cut through an audience of 55 plus. So I think that's really awesome for politics. I think it's really awesome for some product launches. I don't think it's good for a movie opening because I don't think that audience is turning out.
Why did Paramount do it? Why would they do this?
Because this is what's always been done. And this is what the argument's
really
about.
Really? You think they went into it?
The entire conversation is predicated on this article saying that those sorts of things like the Mission Impossible event don't work anymore. And instead, people are after experiential activations. That's the entire premise of what we're talking about here.
Yeah, you're right. That's Lauren McNamara's opinion in the article. And that's what got us talking about this. But what is the thinking? And I'm just putting this out there. What is the thinking behind them continuing to do it, to do this?
Because that's what's always been done. I just don't think that they've evolved their strategies.
You can't just say that's what's always been done when they're spending tens of thousands of dollars to bring stars
out here. You asked me what I think the case is, and I think that's the case. I don't think that PR marketing has evolved to the way that we are all in bubbles now, and that trying to cut through to the 6 o'clock news, I don't think is a particularly good strategy.
Well, okay. I think by those comments, we're putting the public relations industry in a huge hole.
I think that there's lots of opportunities for PR and marketing. I'm a marketing professional myself, or communications marketing rather than PR. I think there's lots of opportunities to be able to cut through, and I just don't think they're necessarily being taken. And I'd say that maybe the activations in Australia just aren't as sophisticated as you're finding from some of the US places. And part of that's probably budgetary, but also when we're thinking about movies and TV shows as well, what's happening in Australia is largely dictated by what's happening overseas. So I'm not even really necessarily blaming local PR as well. Often they're really being given the PR handbook that's been provided to them from overseas. So, you know, keep that in mind as well. So this is not me slamming local PR by any means whatsoever.
But
it's not. I just think that the strategies that are being put in place, like, they're just not as sophisticated as you see elsewhere. You are seeing some experiential activations like what I'm talking about, where every so often you might see, you know, I'm trying to think of a good example. There was someone doing like shop. Remember? Okay. This isn't like a recent example and just, you know, it's apropos of
partially what we're talking about. Activations every time I go to George Street, they always have the have your photo taken with this and it becomes that and then hashtag it this and then there's
At the cinema and at George Street. Okay, yeah. I think that, you know, you need those things at your Westfields. You need those things, well, at sporting events. You need those things just out in the world. You need those things at university campuses. You need these things, you know. There's lots of ways to get out there, and particularly university campuses, I think, are great for this. Shopping centers are great. Places where you have youth audiences, like, that's what you need for opening weekend. Like, unless you're getting that sort of 18 through to, like, 28 audience, you're just not really maximizing your dollar spend, I don't think.
And is really university campuses the place to do that? They're on their social media. Everyone's going on university campuses from their classes to their phones to their laptops.
Yeah.
Are they stopping by to have their photo taken with a cutout Tom Cruise? I don't think so.
Well, probably not Tom Cruise, because I'm not sure that Tom Cruise necessarily has the young person cut through anymore. But
I see my point.
Yeah. I mean, there's that whole conversation about what does a star mean these days? And there was that report from, I forget who it was that did it the other week, talking about the fact that there's actually like a limited number of stars that exist anymore and are not getting youth cut through, which is kind of interesting because we haven't really been creating new stars. Like you got Zendaya and that's about it.
Yeah. No, the biggest stars in the world right now are Spider-Man and the Marvel universe.
Yeah, it's IP. It's not necessarily a thing. But using Spider-Man as an example, put a cardboard standee, but I'm sure it'd be better than that. Some sort of thing where you can get a photo taken with Spider-Man and Spider-Gwen from across the Spider-Verse. Like, young people would do that. Like, that'd be a fun thing to put up on your Insta and actually have people seeing it. But if people are seeing that same, you know, back when I used to go to these red carpet things, like, you know, I'd go and see, like, Ghostbusters Afterlife and take a photo in front of, like, the Ecto-1, if that was the designation of that car, and like, you know, take in front of like an X-Wing or whatever, people look at that going, oh look, that's just Dan and his PR bullshit again. Okay, but if it's like, oh look, that's Steve, he went and got a photo taken with Spider-Man, that's pretty fun, never seen Steve with Spider-Man, like, you know, that just kind of feels unique and different. It's not just the same, it's not the same people who are at events which most people don't get to go to. I'm saying get it out to the people. It's more meaningful for both the people that are there as well as people who see it on their social feeds because it's different.
Yeah, I think that's dangerous.
Cutting through to your average person.
I think that, well, then you're talking about the integrity of the product. Then you're talking about the integrity of the brand. Do you want Steve coming out of his lectures in his the stuff he wore in his bed promoting your Spider-Man movie?
Anyone who's knows Steve, they're not thinking, oh, this really besmirches the Spider-Man brand. Instead, they're like, Steve!
Yeah, maybe. Mm. All right, okay, so that was a hell of, that went all sorts of places. That was quite the intermission. Oh, I need to have a rest. Oh, I should have bought something stronger than water. Anyway, I don't drink anymore. Good to talk to you, Dan Barrett. What have we got next on the running sheet?
What you've got next, because I read the running sheet closely and intently every week, we've got a segment called What Have You Been Watching?
All right, I'm going to start off with this one because I've got a very quick one that I think is a lot of fun in the wake of the Mission Impossible chit-chat that we've just had. I stumbled across on a US streaming service a little 1982 film called Losing It. Now, this was Tom Cruise's first sort of semi-starring role. It is a kind of a sweet, bawdy teen comedy that's actually set in the 1960s, but has all the sort of hallmarks of the early 80s teen romp in it. And it's probably most notable, well, for a couple of things. It stars a huge chunk of the cast that then went on to make Top Gun, not only Tom Cruise, but it stars John Stockwell. It's got Rick Rossovich in there as well. You'll enjoy this, Dan Barrett. It has a very young and a very sweet Shelley Long as the female lead. And on top of all that, I didn't realize this, despite being a huge fan of the filmmaker. It was one of the very first films from Curtis Hanson, who went on to do L.A. Confidential and a bunch of other very highly regarded Hollywood films. So it was the one Tom Cruise film in the Tom Cruise filmography that I hadn't seen. So I decided to settle in for 80-odd minutes of... yes, there's some bawdy, crude stuff in there that's very much of the 80s, but it's also a kind of a sweet sort of story of friendship and mates all coming together. So I didn't mind losing it. I know there's a free dodgy version of it floating around on YouTube. I watched this on the Peacock Network channel out of the US. So that was my what else have I been watching this week.
Is it better than Lion Flams?
Of what?
Is it better than Lion Flams?
Well, it's got no Meryl Streep in it, and it could only have been better with Meryl Streep. I love Lion Flam.
Which one's bawdier and sexier?
Well, the director's cut of Lion Flams goes pretty heavy in certain directions. There's no donkey scene in Lion Flams like losing it, so it's got that going for it.
At any point in Lion Flams, is there a panty raid scene?
in the West Wing of the White House. Yeah, there might have been. Mm. She could have used a panty raid scene. Anyway, what else have you been watching, Dad?
Look, I've had a hefty week. I'm going to start from back to front on the list that I provided you. So in the last couple of weeks, I've been going back and just sort of finishing up a few TV shows that I'd been planning to give a bit of a look to. So one of the ones which I quite liked when I reviewed it on this program, I'd seen the first three episodes of The Big Door Prize. And I remember speaking sort of quite favorably of that one. That's the one with Chris O'Dowd, and he's a high school teacher in a small US town where in said small US town in the local convenience store, like shop, supermarket, it's not very big, but it's not a big town. In their local store, a machine sort of crops up. It's not entirely different to the, I can't think of the name of the machine from Big.
Oh, Zoltan.
Yeah, Zoltan. Okay, so there's not like a mannequin in there, but like you go behind a thing, go behind a screen, and it asks you to put in your social security number, give your fingerprints over, which to me, those are big red flags that nobody seems that concerned about in the show. But it tells you what your potential in life might be. And then it spits out a little card and you look at it going, oh, I could be a baker. And then I'm like, yeah, I always have wanted to bake. And then so my entire life then is, do I go off and become a baker to achieve that? Or do I look at that going, I'm already a baker. Have I actually already achieved my potential? Is there nothing else I could be doing in life at this point? And so you reach like this existential.
When we release it.
Yeah.
I remember the review.
It's a really smart idea. And so I meant to get back to it, but you know, you make me watch a lot of shows every week, Simon, and sometimes you lose track of things. So I went back and rewatched the whole thing. And as much as I was into those first three episodes, I was so much more into it the further I got in, because every episode really takes a look at a different character in the town and builds out kind of like The Simpsons, where, you know, you start out just with this family, but bit by bit, you're really sort of learning who everyone is in the town, what their backstories are to each other, like where those connections are, where those surprising connections are, what their hopes and dreams are. Really smart, fun TV. And it's probably not going to make my top 10 for the year, but it came pretty close. Like, it's right up there. Anyway,
okay,
really good TV. I also watched, and I didn't put this on my list, but I think I watched this in between writing this on the run sheet a couple of days ago and now. Hijack, which is the Idris Elba show, which debuted on Apple TV Plus last week. And I probably would have reviewed it last week had we recorded a program, but you made me do a pre-record. But Hijack, Idris Elba, basically he's a guy who he works as a corporate, a person you send in for negotiations. Okay, so, you know, you want to achieve something, you hire him at a fairly high price and he comes through and Idris takes care of business for you.
Idris could take care of business.
He finds himself on a plane, terrorist takeover, and so he essentially negotiates the terrorist activity taking place on the plane. Anyway.
Okay.
It's fairly generic. This really should be a two-hour movie that's been blown out into a real-time style seven episodes. Because it has gone real-time, it feels a little bit like the TV show 24. I heard some criticisms of the program before I watched it saying that much like 24, they have a bit too much busy work with some family members who aren't necessarily part of the core story, but you know, you kind of want to grow out the world a little bit and take up some time. I thought that was actually a bit unfair. I think that they integrated that a lot more smoothly into the show than 24 ever did. 24 was just awful for these long running storylines that just meandered and went nowhere. This, it actually kind of connected fairly nicely. I think the supporting cast are all super engaging. The one slam against the show is that Archie Punjabi is in the program. And boy, do I dislike her as an on-screen presence just generally. But what I thought was particularly interesting is that anytime that I've seen her from The Good Wife onwards, it's because The Good Wife really builds her into being this person who they really thought was going to be like a thing. But it sort of seems like she's jumped from series to series and they very quickly get cancelled or just never really quite sort of cut through. And in this
she's
one,
the Ted
like,
McGinley of modern television.
I mean, look, maybe. But like in this one, much like Ted McGinley's career at a certain point went to a stage where he was just in small roles and wasn't really the focus of the series. Like she's in this really thankless sort of fairly small role where it could have been any actor playing that. Like you didn't really need like a name actor. And I just don't know, like, was it just a miscast role? Like, was it supposed to be bigger than it was? I'm not sure, but I've watched all seven episodes now, and her character just, you know, seems to just disappear from the screen
maybe
by a certain point.
Maybe some cutting room floor action there. You'll be thrilled to know that on your favorite podcast, Shameless, was Idris Elba this week. I had a good chat with the three gentlemen on the Smartless podcast with Sean Hayes, Jason Bateman, and Will Arnett. You've talked me out of mentioning the documentary series that's on Binge, I want to say at the moment, maybe Stan, that was on Max in the US.
You'll find it on Binge.
Binge, yes. But it's a, I had a ball watching, listening to the podcast, and I had a ball watching the documentary. I don't know what you got against them, but Idris Elba was on this week's one.
I liked two of those three people quite a fair bit, and the third one I thought was really good in Arrested Development. But generally, I just find that podcast just fucking unlistenable. Can't do it.
Why? What's so down about it?
And look, this will sound like a glass houses, stones thing coming from where I'm coming from this one.
It will, yes.
It really annoys me that they do no preparation for that podcast at all. Boy, does that bother me. But no, there's just something... There's something very smarmy about that.
They zip around the place, no, and they have a good time doing it. It's fun to listen. It's certainly fun to watch on the documentary series.
I find none of it fun. I find it all just smarmy and just awful. But anyway, Simon, getting back to Hijack, there's been three episodes that debuted on week one, which was last Friday. There should be another. Actually, I think it's like Wednesday or Thursday nights it's being released. So there's now four episodes. There's seven episodes all up. And I just want to let anyone who started watching that the show holds it together, and the seventh episode is actually genuinely exciting, and it kind of really leads somewhere, which, you know, is kind of interesting. Anyway, good show. There's one dud episode, and I think the dud episode might be the one that airs this coming, whatever day it comes out. So if it's Thursdays, it's like this week's one. So be wary of that. I've been catching up on Run the World season two, which is an African-American, sort of wants to be Sex in the City meets Girls a little bit, with a group of African-American women. The first season had this really interesting accent in it named Andrea Bordeaux, and she was a actor who just really went for it, okay? She, in real life, apparently turned out to be a bit of an anti-vaxxer, and so when all the COVID protocols came down in terms of shooting this, because this season must have been in the bag for like about a year and a half or something now, I think. When it came to filming this, she wasn't able to film the season because she wouldn't get vaxxed, and so written off the show. And the show is definitely poorer for it, but it's still kind of watchable and has been
but healthier.
Possibly. I mean, I'm fine.
Oh, you're okay. Yeah. Well, you anti-vaxxers all stick together, aren't we?
Excuse me. I believe I'm on like vax 5 or 6 or whatever, you know, I can get up to here. I'm all for
it. Let's get to the big deal.
Last one, Indiana Jones and the Dialing of 000.
This is what I want to hear all about. Let's go.
It's better than that fourth one, but the problem with it is, remember two weeks ago, I was talking about I'm a Virgo, and I was saying how refreshing it was watching all these practical effects, and it was really exciting. And then suddenly I find myself watching Indiana Jones and The Dial, and it's all computer animated. Like, I know that the Indiana Jones films in the past have been guilty of some pretty blatant blue screen action. And like, that's fine. But the thing with blue screen is at least it feels tangible. We're in this, like, everything just felt weightless, and I just couldn't really connect with any of it. And then some of the set pieces just weren't really that exciting, and coupled with that fact that it was all CG, I don't know, it just left me a little bit cold. People have criticized the big sort of sci-fi-ish element of the end, but all these films have, like, big sort of silly moments at the end, like, you know, they're drinking from chalices and talking to, you know, people that have been in chambers for, like, thousands of years. Yeah, like, it always leads to something big and silly. So, like, that's fine. But, yeah, I just kind of found it. Also, why did this film have to be, like, 5 hours long? I don't quite understand that either. Like, come on, give me 110 minutes.
Yeah, look, I don't disagree with that. I certainly felt that it honoured the age and the legacy of Indiana Jones far better than, like you say, number four did, and probably as well as we could have hoped for at this stage. It's a very brave opening shot of Indy getting out of his recliner in his white singlet that shows him every bit the 70-year-old odd man that
I didn't need that.
you like your Indy in his fedora and.
Yeah, just put him in a fedora. I will say the opening sequence where you had the de-age Harrison Ford, I actually thought was, like, pretty fun. It kind of felt like we've seen that kind of thing already. Like, it wasn't really that different to him running through the train in Last Crusade or anything. Like, it just kind of felt a little bit like we've sort of done this before. But even so, like, I bought it. Like, it was a little bit sort of iffy in terms of the face. But about 2 or 3 minutes in, like, I'd stop paying attention to that, and I was just kind of in with the vibe of it all. So, like, that was all fine. Okay. But I did think that there's a guest appearance by somebody right at the end of the film. And to me, I kind of wish they hadn't included that sequence. I'd prefer to see Indiana Jones sort of going off into the night a little bit more. Instead, I think they tried to wrap up his story a bit too much with something which is a bit more heartfelt and sentimental, where I kind of
foreshadowed that in the story of his son and what happened to the Shia LaBeouf character. And I think that showed a reunion of sorts that...
I mean, should we just talk about what we're talking about here?
It's Karen Allen.
It's Karen Allen. Karen Allen's back. Yeah, it's Karen Allen. And look, I thought it was kind of nice. Like, the one bit I liked about her coming back into it was echoing that line about, oh, it hurts here and here. And yeah. So that was kind of nice and sweet. But just the overall need to bring her back, I kind of feel as though... When I was hearing the story of Indiana Jones and where he's been up to in like the last 15 years, whatever it's supposed to have been since the last film, like I kind of, you know, I went through like the emotional journey going, oh, this is actually really hurtful. And it's really sad that my hero Indiana Jones is about to go through this. Okay. Yep. But then at the end to have like him sort of be able to reach that emotional fulfillment at the end, it's like, well, I didn't really want that. I'd prefer to see him sort of thinking that he needs to fill his life with something. Because once she comes back, it's basically an existence of he just settles down and that's it. I like the idea that there's going to be another adventure for him.
He's 1,000 years old,
but he's not dead yet, Simon.
He's been deeply, deeply dealt a horrible hand after the... I mean, I got no problem with them bumping off Shia LaBeouf, but the impact it has on the character, on both characters, I thought was really moving, and I thought that brought it... help them reunite over the pain of the loss of their son.
I feel he's already been through that.
I thought there was validity to that plot twist.
To me, Indiana Jones, the one word, if you're going to pull out like word cloud stuff, the one word for me, Indiana Jones is adventurer. And to me, watching that final scene, that's the end of the adventure.
Yeah, that's what it's meant to be.
That's it. I don't want it to be that. I want to know that he's going to go out and have another adventure and he just keeps on going. That's what I want.
All right, okay.
That's what I want from my character. This is what I want from Eternal IP, that he just keeps on going.
Keeps on regurgitating.
I mean, at that age, Simon, he could run for president of the United States.
True. A second term, even.
Mm.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, what an adventure.
Speaking of historic figures, let's have a look at this week in history. July 9, 1968. Hang on, I've forgotten the answer. Let me just go to the page with the answers on it. Here we are. July 9, 1968. It drew 10 million viewers. The BBC TV broadcast called Farewell featured the final performance of which Australian pop group?
See, I want to say it's the Easy Beats, but it's not because they were like another year or two after that. So,
They were called The Seekers. We lost the lead singer, the late Judith Durham, just passed away recently. They were the first Australian pop music group to achieve chart and sales success in the UK and the US, and they had this huge farewell show on the BBC. July 10, 1978, US network ABC World News Tonight premieres with Max Robinson hosting. What made it a significant moment in US TV history?
Okay, so I can't think of anything that would make it a significant moment. What I'm going to say doesn't feel significant, but it certainly feels like it's something. My understanding of Max Robinson is he wasn't the only host of that, so he had multiple hosts of the news. Is that what we're talking about?
He was US TV's first black news anchor.
Oh, okay. Well, then that is a significant moment in US history.
That is a significant thing.
Here's the thing. I knew him by name. I had no idea that he wasn't just some white guy
There we go. And on July 14, 1992, what happened to Growing Pains star Nell Carter on this day?
Okay, can I contend this? Because to my knowledge, Nell Carter was never in Growing Pains.
Really? What was she in?
I don't know, Simon. But I know Growing Pains, and I know that she wasn't, like, loosely.
Oh, okay. Maybe they've got that wrong as well. Gee, I've got to check this website more.
You really do.
What happened to Growing Pains Nell Carter? What happened to actress Nell Carter, who we remember from her vivid sitcom career and a lot of great shows?
Which one, Simon?
Well, what was the other one? Not Growing Pains, but with Tootie. What was the one with Tootie in it?
Oh, I don't think she was ever in... Oh, gosh, what is that program called?
Come on, Dad, what is it?
I can tell you about series star George Clooney from it.
Yeah, maybe so. Anyway, what happened to Nell Carter? And I'll get the answer to what she's been in that we're all confusing. You answer that question.
I mean, no, I don't really know Nicole Carter well enough to be able to tell you what happened.
She's a wonderful, wonderful actress and has survived brain surgery. She had brain surgery on this day. She had diabetes from when she was very young. And in 1992, she had brain surgery to remove an aneurysm. She was in Give Me a Break.
Okay, which did not star Tootie or the great Kurt Cameron.
An angel.
Hang
on, we're going to find out. I know, look. Email us.
At no point did she...
podcast@gmail.com and tell us what Nell Carter was in.
I can tell you this, Simon. At no point did she star opposite Boner in Growing Pains.
I think I'm confusing it with Give Me a Break. That might be what I'm confusing it with. Anyway, she survived brain surgery. That's kind of a big deal. Well done, Nell Carter, whoever you are.
Are you... Okay, we're going to have a conversation about this in history segment.
Yeah, this needs a bit of work. I might have to get a different website. There's been a few cock-ups lately because I really do just cut and paste whatever's written on the
In no way am I surprised.
All right, birthday time.
No, not happy birthday. No, not that. Please, no, not happy birthday.
All right, birthdays, my friend. This one I think you're going to get. I've got a lot of familiar faces in there. July 9, 1928, Bob Crane. July 9, 1940, Patrick Stewart. July 12, 1990, your girlfriend, Rachel Brosnahan. And July 14, 1985, from the aforementioned Dial of Destiny, one Phoebe Waller-Bridge. Now, this has all to do with their small screen work. What do these four people have in common?
Okay.
Patrick Stewart, Rachel Brosnahan, Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
When you say small screen... That makes me think about Bob Crane and home movies.
What? No, not that small. And they were weird. I wouldn't ask questions about those.
Are you sure? Okay.
I mean, their TV shows is what I mean. Not their kinky Super 8 Nazi outfits.
I'm trying to work out where the connection... I mean, I can think of like a Bob Crane and a Patrick Stewart sort of connection, but that doesn't really make that much sense for a Brosnahan, or as I like to think of her as cinema's Lois Lane. Or Phoebe Waller-Bridge, which I like to think of her as one of the worst things about the Dial of Destiny.
Yeah, she wasn't good.
I quite like her, but she just wasn't right for that film. It just didn't really... It just felt like bad casting there, I think, maybe.
All right.
Yeah.
Think of all their small screen work. Think of who they played in their small screen work. And think of how that may reflect in the answer.
No, I mean, I'm trying to trying to find a connection between Brosnahan and Phoebe Waller-Bridge, and I can't really do that either. No, I've got nothing. Wait.
What?
I was going to say they all play Jewish characters when I'm not Jewish, but that's probably not true for Patrick Stewart. And I don't know what. I don't know what religion that Mikhail identified as.
They all played the titular characters in their TV series. Hogan's Heroes, Star Trek, Picard.
Come Ms. on, Mabel, Simon.
And Fleabag. That's easy.
Try a bit harder.
The titular character. That was hard enough. It got you.
What did you say?
Hogan's Heroes.
Are we saying...
Hogan's Heroes.
Sorry, Simon. Are we saying that Phoebe Waller-Bridge played a character called Fleabag?
Yeah, absolutely. According to IMDb, the lead character, she was called Fleabag.
Really? Is it one of these things where we never actually hear the name of the character and then...
Maybe.
Because in retrospect, I can't think of the name of that character.
Yeah, exactly. Well, on IMDb, and I checked all of this because I didn't know her name was Fleabag either, but the character's name on IMDb is Fleabag. And of course, Rachel Brosnahan is Mrs. Maisel and Stewart is Star Trek Picard and Hogan's Heroes for the great Bob Crane. So there you go. That was a good one.
Yeah. Character Fleabag, crazy.
It's true. All right, sign us off, my friend. I'm ready to go home.
Okay, I mean, I've been ready to go home for about 50 minutes now, but here we go. Folks, this has been Screen Watching. My name's Dan Barrett, joined by Simon Foster. If you want to follow me, sorry, I didn't really find nothing on this rundown until right now. You can find me on Threads at the Dan Barrett. You can start your day with my free newsletter. It's called Always Be Watching at alwaysbewatching.com. It's got the big stories in TV, streaming, and film. And then you got on Fridays, the Always Be Streaming newsletter, which recounts the big shows that launched this very week, or that very week, depending.
How's the Threads experience been for you?
Threads, we're now about, 36 hours into the whole Threads launch. It's interesting. I think it's got a lot of potential. I'm not happy to be back in the world of Zuckerberg, but I'm happier not to be in the world of Musk, and I don't know if there's really going to be much of a choice.
Interesting.
Yeah. Right, it's got potential.
All right. You can read my words at screen-space.net or at Screenspace on Facebook. A lot of screen watching socials to check out. We're on Facebook at Screen Watching Podcast, on Twitter at @screen_watching. Over on the Screen Watching YouTube channel this week, you can see me singing Happy Birthday to Tom Cruise. You can email us at screenwatchingpodcast@gmail.com with any questions, answers, opinions, or abusive language, which we'd rather you didn't do.
Okay. Anyway, this has been Screen Watching. We'll be back next week. Do we have a big movie next week?
Don't think so. No, it's sort of that in-between period from what I can remember.
So do we have a weekend between Mission Impossible, a weekend in between Mission Impossible and then the Oppenheimer Barbie?
Yes, that's what it is. It's quite a week next week in preparation for the Barbieheimer week.
Okay, cool.
As far as I can remember.
Yeah,
things will slow down. Why, is television picking up at all? I've got nothing in there for next week already. Got the Barbies and the Oppenheimers in the week after that. So what are we going to talk about next week?
It's generally just a little bit quiet. What are we talking about next week? We've got the return of the After Party. I might talk about that maybe.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Ooh.
All right.
It is a quiet one.
Come back and listen to us, yeah.
Yeah, the After Party.
We'll figure something out. It's what we do.
Oh, yeah, I think I'm really have to get it pretty creative on this one. I was going to say I could jump ahead and try to like give a bit of a preview for Justified City Primeval, but I'm going to need something to talk about the following week. So,
what do all those words mean? I've never heard of that. What's it called? Justified City Primeval.
Yeah. The TV series Justified has a new sequel TV miniseries, and that miniseries is called City Primeval. Justified is the series with Timothy Olyphant with the hat.
I know. Yep. We've got the man with the hat in it. Yes, that is probably the one show more than any other show that I've had people, not so much a lot of people have watched, but so many are just so in love with it. Those that watch it are just fervent Justified heads. It's one that everyone desperately trying to get me to watch. So maybe I'll check out a few episodes.
It's quite good. But I'd say there's probably another 10 shows ahead of that one that you need to watch.
Mm.
Yeah.
Anything with Nell Carter in it.
I'd certainly give me a break a shot.
Bye-bye, Dan.
Simon, if you don't have a exciting movie to talk about next week, I've got an idea. But
we'll talk.
We'll have a meeting after this podcast.
We won't have a meeting. We haven't had a production meeting in 2 years.
I wouldn't call it a production meeting.
Because I rang the wrong number. We had to talk about something.
Yeah, but thankfully my mum organised that week, so it's going to be fine.
She was very productive. I've got to say, that was one of our better episodes.
Let's get out of here. It's been silly. Okay, folks, this has been Screen Watching. We'll see you next week.